ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 26th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, headline annual inflation worsens ahead of the RBA's last rates call for the year. And one of the biggest repair projects on the reef fights to stop coral bleaching.
So we're actually trying to help the reef become more resilient and adapt to climate change. That needs to be tackled to obviously for the reefs to be able to be sustainable into going into the future.
Much of Queensland is sweating through heatwave conditions today, while in the southeast of the state, residents are bracing for severe thunderstorms for the third day in a row. Brisbane is once again in the firing line for heavy rain, large hail and damaging winds. Across the rest of the country, it appears the fire season is already upon us. Rachel Mealy reports.
The last days of spring are seeing hot and humid weather across much of the country. In New South Wales, high winds have coupled with high temperatures to trigger fire warnings in 10 districts, including Sydney. On the lower central west plains, the fire risk is catastrophic. Mark Pickford is the inspector of the Orana Rural Fire Services.
I think today is going to be a shocker if we have a fire start anywhere in most of the western state, even though lower central west plains is catastrophic. The upper central west plains are extreme.
He says the RFS is ready to go.
We've been preparing for today for a couple of days now. Got our heavy plant blokes lined up. Aviation, there's a plane sitting on the tarmac in Dubbo. We've got our volunteers prepped. We will have the fire control centre open for an incident ready to go. It's all systems go, all alert, ready to go.
Dozens of schools in New South Wales are closed today. Miriam Bradbury is a senior forecaster at the Weather Bureau. She says it's the first time the warning needle has reached catastrophic this year.
What we call the fuel in the landscape, that is what there is to burn, is really dry. So it is a volatile situation. It's a situation where any fire that gets going could spread very quickly and move very erratically. So it really is the strongest of all warnings to all of us, particularly in those areas under a total fire ban, that we need to be really sensible and really aware of this risk today.
It's not just fire risk. In northeast New South Wales and southeast Queensland, thunderstorms could be on the way.
There is even a chance we could see high-end severe weather impacts, that is giant-sized hail, greater than 5 centimetres in diameter, and destructive wind gusts, up to 125 kilometres an hour, with storms across parts of the northern rivers and mid-north coast.
And in WA, warnings relating to ex-tropical cyclone Fina remain.
That risk of heavy falls continues today, possibly into tomorrow as well. There's going to be a lot of moisture continuing in the atmosphere in that part of Australia for the coming days.
Queenslanders are still cleaning up from the pummeling delivered by Monday's hailstorm, which saw trees uprooted, roofs ripped off, and cars flipped. Scott Revell is the acting chief of the Queensland State Emergency Service.
It has devastated a large area, so we have had jobs all the way from the Gold Coast through to the North Coast, and even a couple of jobs in the Bundaberg region. So it has impacted a large area.
Dr. Tim Rawpack is the senior lecturer at the University of New South Wales Institute for Climate Risk and Response. He says it's too soon to tell if the severe storm season has been triggered by the changing climate.
We do get a lot of variability from year to year in hailstorms across Australia. So it could be that this is just an unusually active year, but the level of that, of how unusual that is kind of yet to be seen. We really need to see the season out before we can say.
But he says as the climate warns, it will have an impact on how storms form, and those storms will produce larger hailstones.
One of the things that we would expect in a warmer atmosphere is that you just have more energy available to form the storms, and the updraft is what causes the stones to get very large in a hailstorm. And with more energy, you can have a stronger updraft. So we would kind of expect that in a warmer atmosphere, the ability for storms to produce larger hailstones would become greater as the atmosphere gets warmer.
Tim Rawpack from the University of New South Wales, sending that report by Rachel Mealy. The latest official figures on the economy show inflation re-emerging as a major economic problem. Annual inflation rose to 3.8% in October, according to new monthly data released by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Our business reporter David Taylor joined me earlier. David, before we jump into these figures, this is a new kind of way of looking at Bureau of Statistics data. What is the significance of that?
That's right, Andy. This is the first release of the complete monthly consumer price index from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Now, what the Bureau has said at the timing of the release is that today's release marks the transition from the quarterly CPI to the complete monthly CPI. Now, it bills it as Australia's primary measure of headline inflation. Don't need to worry about the jargon too much, but the word complete monthly CPI keeps on cropping up. And that's because the previous monthly inflation indicator that we've had up until this point doesn't give the Reserve Bank, which really needs solid information on what price rises are doing across the economy, just doesn't give it enough of an idea of the extent of price rises in the economy, specifically, Andy, over time. There was too much volatility in that indicator. So this is meant to give a much broader view of price trends in the economy to put it in a better position of making interest rate decisions.
So what does that all that mean when we're talking about rise in inflation and the state of inflation across the country?
That 3.8% is the headline figure, and it's a little bit more bumpy. It goes a bit more up and down than a figure I'll give you a bit later, Andy. But it is pointing to the fact that price pressures are still in the economy. I'll give you a few examples, Andy. Housing up 6%. Now, within that category, you've got rental prices up 4.2% in the month of October, and the cost of building a new home up 1.7% again in the month of October. They're pretty steep increases. But let's go to electricity now, because those people receiving bills in the paper that have thought, I thought the cost of living crisis was over and getting a bit of bill shock will understand this figure I'm about to give you. Electricity prices rose 37% in the 12 months to October. And the annual rise in electricity costs is primarily related to state government electricity rebates in Queensland and Western Australia being used up by households. So it's coming back online there. Healthcare, Andy, this is out-of-pocket healthcare costs, up 4%, and education up 5.4%.
So the RBA will powwow once more before Christmas, and this data is timely, but do you think it will open the door to a rate cut or rate hold or a rate increase?
Look, I think there is no question a rate cut is off the cards potentially for this entire rate cutting cycle. The trimmed mean, Andy, remember I said earlier we looked at the headline figure, another measure which is far more, I guess it smooths out all of the bumps and volatility in the data. It gives the Reserve Bank a great picture of price rises in the economy. It came in at 3.3%. That's the trimmed mean. That is outside of the Reserve Bank's comfort zone of between 2 and 3%. So some economists are of the opinion that just rules out any rate cut. I spoke to one economist this morning, however, that said that there is the potential, a very slight potential, for the Reserve Bank to be pressured to increase interest rates sooner than it would otherwise want. So plenty of data here, Andy, but the key message is that price rises in the economy are still a bit sticky.
Business correspondent David Taylor. It's already hard to speak to a real human at a bank or on the phone, and if that frustrates you, you'd better take note of what's already quietly happening in the banking sector right now. This week, Bendigo Bank announced an agreement with Google to use Gemini Enterprise Artificial Intelligence to assess loan applications and fraud detection. In August, the Commonwealth Bank announced OpenAI will bring advanced AI to customers and employees. It all comes as the federal government announces that it will set up an Artificial Intelligence Safety Institute to assess emerging capabilities and evaluate the risks of the technology. Michael Mehmet is an associate professor in marketing at the University of Wollongong. He joined me earlier. Michael, we've seen AI quietly arrive in industries and industrial sectors like law, academia, accounting, media. In what ways are the big four banks already using AI?
What they're doing with AI at the moment is actually kind of invisible to customers. So essentially about 85% of AI work happens behind the scenes. Employers are testing, refining tools. There's still what we call a human in the loop in this situation, either with fraud detection, loan applications, even scam detection. So companies like CommBank have reported 50% reduction in scam losses thanks to tools like NameCheck, where employees can work with the AI to check things out. There's also a lot of back office revolution. Like JP Morgan created what's called a coin platform, which essentially goes through and looks at documents and provides reports. And they're saving hundreds and thousands of hours worth of time and quite costly time. So as you've mentioned before, AI is coming into call centers and helping automate notes, helping with loan applications. Essentially, AI currently, in the vast majority of cases, is helping staff deal better with customers, respond with customers. So it is embedded. On the customer-facing side, people have probably used a chatbot that has an AI component to it. They might have got alerts or investment advice, but that essentially only equates to about 15% of AI use on the customer-facing side.
And that's set to change, particularly with these new agreements announced by some of the big four and other banks. We're really about to enjoy a revolution when it comes to front-of-house AI in terms of how we interact with our banking institutions, aren't we?
Yes, definitely. So things are moving forward and they're moving forward very quickly. So we'll obviously have AI that's going to help employees still. But there's a move now where they're going to start playing a bigger role in decision making. So some banks are testing financial coaches that like proactively message you with personalized like savings tips. It's what we call autonomous finance systems that essentially can help you manage your money with minimal input from you. So they can basically say, okay, we'll automatically move idle cash from it to a better performing account. They can be able to even help you refinance debt when rates drop. So you don't actually have to physically call up a bank or do anything. So essentially they'll be there to help you optimize your bills and your investments. This is actually quite transformative. It's what we call agentic AI. So if you want to think of agentic AI as a tool that makes decisions very much similar to what a human would, but without human input or very minimal human input. So think of it like a self-driving car, but for your finance.
And for the big four banks, this all spells out huge productivity gains and therefore profit potential. In fact, consulting firm McKinsey looked at some of the productivity gains on offer with AI in the banking sector. What did they find?
The McKinsey report was, even when I read it, I was stunned by the numbers that came out of it. So just with basic AI use and, you know, with just some automation, they're saving 25% of productivity. But when you unleash AI's full autonomy, that agentic AI, they're reporting anywhere between 200 and 2,000% increases in productivity. I haven't misspoken there, like 200 to 2,000% increases in productivity.
This all must spell disaster for banking employees. And in fact, one bank was already tripped up when they tried to ditch staff for technology, weren't they?
Yes. Well, the CommBank a little while ago had some might call it a significant misstep. There was 45 workers redundant after they unknowingly had trained the AI system that replaced them. One of the workers actually confronted the CEO. The CEO obviously said, we didn't handle that well, and they were re-employed. But it kind of highlights a big concern is if agentic AI is as good as OpenAI and Google claim it is, and it's going to increase efficiencies to the point it's going to increase efficiencies, where does it stop? What happens to people without work? Like if the agentic tool can do so many things across so many different sectors and it can do it better than us, the word redeployment we often hear, if the technology advancing across all the sectors, where are people then redeployed to? So the bigger question is like, who is this actually benefiting? Is it actually benefiting us as the customer or the organization and their bottom line? So it's something that governments need to really consider when it comes to legislation and recommendations to sectors like banks moving forward.
Michael Mamet is an associate professor in marketing at the University of Wollongong. Really appreciate your time, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Overseas, and Ukraine says an understanding has been reached with the US on its peace plan ahead of two key forthcoming meetings. Following tense negotiations from both sides over the last week, US President Donald Trump is sending officials to Moscow and Ukraine, as Kathleen O'Connor reports.
Police officers in Kyiv surround a huge crater in the ground after Russia launched another wave of attacks on Ukraine's capital overnight. 22 missiles were fired on city buildings and energy infrastructure, killing at least 7 people. It's cut residents off from water, electricity and heat as the city enters its winter season.
The walls have been knocked down. The panels are standing, not even supported. Thank God I'm alive.
It's very sad that everyone is just watching while we get such destruction.
A Ukrainian attack on southern Russia also killed 3 people and damaged homes overnight. As the fighting drags on, international leaders met to discuss US President Donald Trump's latest 28-point plan to end the Russia-Ukraine war. Despite the prospect of large land concessions and a blocking of entering NATO, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has declared he's ready to meet with Mr. Trump to further negotiate his proposed peace deal.
Ukraine has the framework developed by our teams in Geneva. That framework is on the table, and we are ready to move forward together with the United States of America.
President Trump revealed his plan to end fighting last week, setting off talks with political leaders across Europe, Russia, and the United States. The US president spoke in Washington, D.C.
I think we're getting very close to a deal. We'll find out. I thought that one would have been gone quicker. We did 8. I thought that would have been an easier one, but I think we're making progress.
He posted on social media his original 28-point peace plan has been fine-tuned with input from both Ukraine and Russia, with only a few remaining points of disagreement. Mr. Trump has directed Special Envoy Steve Witkoff to meet with Vladimir Putin in Moscow and his Army Secretary Dan Driscoll to meet with the Ukrainians, but claims he will only meet with the country's leaders himself once the deal is in its final stages. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer says while good progress has been made, Europe needs to present a united front against Russia.
And it's only if Russia believes we're serious to responding to any violation that this will underpin a lasting peace.
At a news conference, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says they're ready to negotiate, but are still waiting on official details of the peace plan.
No one has officially communicated anything official to us. We have it, but through unofficial channels. We are naturally ready to discuss specific wording because a number of issues there certainly require clarification.
President Trump has indicated he'll give Ukraine until next Thursday to agree to a peace proposal. Keir Giles is from the Russia and Eurasia program at the US-based think tank Chatham House.
The long-term objective for Russia is the destruction of Ukraine and erasing it from the map. But they are patient in terms of how they get there. It can be a step-by-step process. So anything that brings them closer to that aim will be welcomed and will be a bonus.
Keir Giles from Chatham House, sending that report by Kathleen O'Connor. As the Sudanese civil war rages on, neither of the two warring sides have formally accepted the United States' proposed peace plan. The Rapid Support Forces announced a 3-month humanitarian truce, which is part of the deal, but barely 24 hours later launched an attack on a Sudanese armed forces base. Meanwhile, the military group has rejected the truce, citing its bias towards their opponents. Kimberly Price has the story.
In a camp in Al Daba in northern Sudan, children run around tents where hundreds of people have been sheltering. Earlier this week, one grandmother described how the 2.5-year civil war had taken its toll on her grandson.
He lost his hearing during the war. Recently, we were living near the air defence building, so because of the heavy fighting and the bombing, he lost his hearing.
More than 150,000 people have died and nearly 3 million people have been displaced since the civil war broke out in April 2023. For a moment, it looked like peace talks for Sudan were heading towards a ceasefire. The Rapid Support Forces Chief Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo announced they would move forward with the first stage of a proposal put forward by the Quad, a group consisting of the United States, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia.
In response to international efforts, I announce a humanitarian ceasefire, including a cessation of hostilities for 3 months.
But the US advisor for African Affairs, Massad Boulos, says neither the Sudanese army nor the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces have formally accepted the proposed humanitarian truce. Barely 24 hours after the RSF announced their ceasefire, they launched an attack on a Sudanese armed forces base in Baba Nusa, a town in the West Kordofan state and the site of a new front line in the civil war. Massad Boulos says the RSF and the SAF have been consulted for the Quad's peace plan.
It was worked out with both sides, and there are no objections as to the substance of the document and the mechanisms that it provides.
The Sudanese Armed Forces Chief, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, rejects that claim.
Last week, or 2 weeks ago, they presented another paper. They didn't look at our response and they didn't consider what we said to them. The proposal is the worst one presented.
Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow at the African Program at the Centre for Strategic and International Studies. He says the Rapid Support Forces ceasefire declaration was a tactical ploy.
I think it was an opportunity for the RSF to try to position themselves as the more reasonable party, the party ready for peace, the more responsible party in this conflict. But of course, that lasted, you know, barely 24 hours before they relaunched a new offensive.
He wants to see more international pressure placed on the warring parties to end the conflict.
Diplomatic calls for a ceasefire is not really pressure. Pressure would be threatening the use of sanctions, other diplomatic isolation tools, you know, designating them under the Foreign Terrorist Act of the United States.
The stalling of peace talks comes after Amnesty International released a report alleging that the Rapid Support Forces has committed war crimes in the North Darfur region of Sudan.
Kimberly Price. Scientists and First Nations people have teamed up to help restore parts of the Great Barrier Reef hit by coral bleaching. It's expected to be one of the biggest repair projects on the reef so far, with participants collecting, growing and monitoring baby coral. There are hopes more traditional owners will join the program as it continues. Here's Claudia Sullivan.
On the surface, Great Keppel Island off the coast of central Queensland looks like a tropical paradise. But under the waves, it's a different story. The section of the Great Barrier Reef that fringes the island, also known as Whopper, was one of the worst hit by bleaching in 2024.
And so we're trying to target some of those reefs where that used to be pristine or has been damaged by the bleaching event. We're trying to target those as restoration sites.
That's Jordan Ivey, the Australian Institute of Marine Sciences Indigenous Futures Coordinator. The Bundjalung man and South Sea Islander is taking part in a restoration trial to help the reef rebuild.
So we're actually trying to help the reef become more resilient and adapt to climate change. Obviously, climate change is a big issue.
Indigenous rangers are a key part of the project, working with scientists to help baby coral survive. Wapabara Land and Sea Ranger Supervisor Tashinta Barney says Indigenous cultural knowledge is helping to guide the process, including identifying the best sites to place baby coral.
There is cultural significant areas where there's just men's areas, so women aren't allowed to go, and there's women's areas where men aren't allowed to go, and we do have burial areas out there, so we try to stay away from those areas.
To help restore the reef, the team has been collecting, monitoring, and placing egg and sperm from the coral spawning that happens every year in protective floating pools. Within the pools, rangers like Tashinta Barney are placing ceramic seeding devices, which coral larvae will settle down and grow on before the devices are taken and spread across the reef.
Doing a bunch of different activities and experiments, we're just trying to put them out there and see what works and what doesn't work. This year we have a new larvae pool with a different design that we actually put racks in. It's got a whole canopy and everything to keep the fresh water out. So hopefully that helps it stay alive while it's out there, so then we can put more back into the ocean.
It's a big undertaking, with about 15,000 of the so-called coral seeding devices to be distributed. And there are hopes this year's crop will beat the previous release of 100,000 baby coral in 2023. Tashinta Barney is hoping the number of traditional owners taking part will grow too, to include more of the 70 groups with ties to the Great Barrier Reef.
It brings so much joy to my heart. It's something very close to me, with being with where my family comes from and what we do and what we represent. I'm just glad to be a part of a program like this where we can hopefully learn and bring it back ourselves to do it in futures. No matter where you come from, if you're willing to learn and come be a part of something, come and do it. Don't hold back.
Sea Ranger Tashinta Barney, ending that report by Claudia Sullivan. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Living in Australia, we're all pretty invested in the weather. So when the Bureau of Meteorology, yes, the bomb, changed its website, almost everyone had a view about it. And that was before we realised, they'd forgotten to tell us, it cost close to $100 million to build it. Today, the ABC's lead rural reporter in Victoria, Justine Longmore, on the website debacle. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.